Happy New Year. Except for fascists. Fascists have a bad year. But if you're listening to this, I'm confident you are not a fascist. And so I hope life is treating you kindly thus far into 2026. And I hope we can do our part to make it just a little bit better. Case in point, today we're featuring a conversation precisely about making the world a little bit better. Literally, as in environmental restoration. And also, littorally, because we're specifically talking about seagrass restoration. Today's edition of High Fidelity is hosted by Eric Higgs, who you'll recognize from our Nature by Design series from Season 3, and also Mountain Legacies from Season 4. Eric is sitting down with Laura Govers about her work bringing eelgrass back to the Netherlands' shallow and deeply altered Wadden Sea. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Eric Higgs. I'm a professor in the School of Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria. And I've had a chance to participate in a number of Future Ecologies episodes in Seasons 3 and Season 4. And it's an enormous pleasure to be part of this High Fidelity series. So I'm joined today by Laura Govers, who's going to introduce herself. Laura?
Hi, I'm Laura Govers. I'm a professor in marine conservation ecology from the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And I'm visiting UVic for a while, and this has been my fourth year that I'm here. So I'm very honored and pleased to be a guest on this show because I'm actually a big fan.
Yeah, and you listened to the special episode on Oostvaardersplassen a few years ago and you gave it a thumbs up.
Definitely, yeah. That was very interesting to kind of hear about that also from a Canadian perspective.
Well, I want to begin by taking the two of us back to a particular March morning in 2018 when you and I set off with a group of people in the very early hours of the morning to the Isle of Grind, which you know really well. Talk us through that and what it was like that morning and what we experienced.
Yeah, so it was a pretty gray or like dark morning in March. So Grind is a tiny, tiny island in the middle of the Wadden Sea, which is like this huge intertidal area in the northern part of the Netherlands, stretching along the coast of the Netherlands, Germany, Denmark. It's the largest intertidal flood area in the world. So it has massive ecological value. And we set out to kind of study this tiny island in the middle of the Dutch Wadden Sea. So we went on a boat and then we drove there. So it's about an hour's drive on a boat. But then there's no jetties, no piers. It's just this enormous tide flat, 50 square kilometers. So that means you have to hop on a smaller boat and then they drop you off in the middle of the water. And then you have to put on waders, right? And then you wait for kilometers to get to that island because that tide flat is extremely shallow. And then you get to one of the very few places in the Netherlands where there's no people. So it's one of the very few uninhabited islands in the Netherlands.
I just remember the captain of the small boat, the second boat that we were on, and he was heading towards this speck on the horizon, and then he just stopped. And he said, okay, we're getting out here. And I said, where is here? Right, because I had waders on, like chest waders, and then we just all jumped into the water.
Yeah, you just have to trust the captain, well, and the researchers who are familiar with that area. So you just jump in and it's like, yeah, it's like a meter deep and then you wait for kilometers through the water before you actually land on the island. Yeah.
Yeah, infinitesimally getting shallower and shallower and shallower until finally you get onto something that looks a little bit like land.
Yeah, it is very tiny. It's like 60 hectares. I don't know how much that is in acres. So it's really tiny. So, and it's very flat. So there's one tree that accidentally got there. So yeah, all you see is a bit of vegetation. And then there's this tower. So they built this bird warden house. So it's a breeding island. So there's a house for the bird wardens to stay in summer. That's kind of all there is.
Yeah, and the height above sea level at the highest part would be what?
It is now 4 meters, but because of nature management measures, but it used to be like 1.82 max.
Wow.
Meters.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a photograph from that day taken later, and I've converted it to black and white, and it shows the sand turning into the water, turning into the sky, and it's all the same color.
Yeah, especially on a March morning when it's like generally gray and when there's no wind, it becomes foggy as well. So it's just, it all blends together. And it's kind of interesting because in March, you really feel like you're on an uninhabited island. But when you're there in summer and it's a clear day, you can kind of see the harbor 10 kilometers away from a distance. And then on the other side of the island, you can see the strain of barrier islands and the lighthouses there. So then you suddenly see that you're actually like right on one of the busiest kind of shipping routes off the Wadden Sea area.
Wow, cool.
Yeah.
And those barrier islands separate the Wadden Sea from the North Sea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what were we doing there?
Yeah. So we were actually at the time doing a research project there because the Island of Gind has been disappearing for almost a century. So they built this huge closure dam in the northern part of the Netherlands, separating a part of this Wadden Sea area from what is now a freshwater lake. And because of that, the whole system actually changed. The tidal amplitude, so the difference between high and low tide, became higher, and then the island started to erode slowly. It had a massive ecological value because it's a very important breeding site for coastal breeding birds like terns and all kinds of gull species, plovers. And it's a very important roosting site. So the Wadden Sea has massive intertidal flats, and that is very important for all these migratory wading birds on the East Atlantic Flyway. So they actually stop in the Wadden Sea on their migration between Africa and their breeding areas in the Arctic. So it's both these breeding birds and these migratory wading birds that actually make use of that island. So you can imagine if you lose that island, you'd lose massive ecological value.
Right. And what were you doing there? I remember that we were checking some research sites. Tell us about those.
So in 2016, the nature management organization of that, who manages that island, Natuurmonumenta, decided together with another governmental organization, Rijkswaterstaat, to kind of put a massive nature management measure in place. I would call it kind of a rehabilitation measure. So they added about 200,000 cubic meters of sand to that island on the western side, so the exposed side, as a kind of a sand nourishment to prevent further erosion of the island, because it used to erode like with 7 meters a year. So you could kind of see the erosion happening, and like especially in that house of the bird ones, if you'd be there on a winter storm, like you'd see the sea get closer with every storm.
But you wrote a book on this island.
Yeah.
Which is a beautiful book. And you noted that historically, prior to the 20th century, the island was constantly moving.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Of course, yeah, it was a moving island. It's this very special type of island that naturally moves with like 5 to 10 meters a year. And it actually, the original position was like, or well, the first position where it was measured by people was like a kilometer further to the northwest. However, because of all these nature management measures, like since the start of the 20th century, over 1.5 million cubic meters of sand has been deposited there, and the island has been fixed because the Dutch like to build dikes. So that's also what they did on that island. So it kind of stopped moving. And the question is also, well, of course, there's always a risk. You can say, like, let's try to get it to move again, but that may also, like, then it may be at risk of getting lost. And it has this important ecological value. So that's why they're managing it and not completely letting it go. So that's also why it's still 4 meters above sea level and not 2 meters.
Right. And just so people don't get the idea that the island has legs, it was that back before a lot of the development in that part of the Wadden Sea, there was a constant flow of sediment in the Wadden Sea with all these currents. And it would take away, the erosion would take away sand on one side of the island and build it up on the other. So in effect, it kept moving that way.
Yeah, but it mostly grew during extreme events because it's not like a barrier island. It's in a very fetch limited. So it means that there's very low wave heights actually because it's sheltered. So that means it only grows during storm events when there's lots of energy in the system. So then the sand would actually land on the island, form a small barrier, and then the salt marsh would grow on the other side. Right. And that is how it would move. And it was so big at some point that there were people living on it. We know that in the 13th, 14th century, people were living on it.
Yeah. So that's a long time ago. There was a monastery there.
There was a monastery, yeah. Yeah. So you can still find bricks there. But of course, they're not from that place because the monastery used to be like a kilometer away. But it's just, they get washed out somewhere else and then they land on the island.
So you were looking at ecological applications to try some new techniques. with getting shellfish to anchor there, because shellfish don't stay around when it's just sort of moving sand and dunes. So what were you doing?
Yeah, so actually the project had several components. So we were looking at the effectiveness of that management measure, the rehabilitation, like on an island scale for the geomorphology. So for the movement of sediment, we were looking at the birds, but also at restoration measures around the island and how that could potentially also benefit the island. So we looked at possibilities for establishing blue mussel reefs because they have disappeared. So we installed these artificial matrices to trap mussel larvae.
Right. And how did that work out?
Well, that was very interesting. So it was pretty challenging. So these structures were 3D printed biodegradable structures and they were very novel and they didn't work too well. So the layers kind of peeled off and all these mussels settled. They settled on the structures, but they settled on the top part of the structures. The layers peeled off. So then we lost the mussels and also a lot of the structures sanded in. So we ended up removing. It was an experiment. It was not large scale restoration, but it seemed that that area was not suitable and also that structure was not suitable at the time.
Yeah, it was tricky. It's hard to figure out how to make it work. But what you were focused on was kind of ecosystem engineering with species that would kind of kickstart development, right? And you've been carrying that on with other species
yeah.
in your work.
So the idea was that we could establish mussel reefs that would then kind of start as a facilitation cascade so that the natural shellfish reefs can actually provide some shelter and then some other species might establish. So we actually put the structures out and then we planted eelgrass behind those structures. And we even looked at like how far would these structures need to have an effect to be able to establish salt marsh. So we really looked at this kind of facilitation cascade for ecosystem restoration. And because we were working on that project, we were walking around this enormous tide flat, 50 square kilometers. We actually planted eelgrass behind those structures in 2017. Didn't work. It was way too dynamic. Everything just washed out, the seeds, the plants, everything we put there. But then we, like the year after, in 2018, we planted eelgrass on the northeast side, very sheltered side. And it suddenly took off after years of trying by our team, but also by other researchers.
Yeah, you're known for your work with seagrasses. So tell me a little more about some of the recent work you've been doing with seagrass restoration. What does that look like?
Yeah, so seagrass restoration is actually a huge theme in the Netherlands because we also have a social, well, cultural history with seagrass. So the Wadden Sea used to be full of eelgrass. It's the same species of eelgrass that actually occurs here in British Columbia. So that is pretty interesting. There used to be 150 square kilometers of that eelgrass, and it was harvested commercially. So there were whole fleets of these commercial eelgrass fishermen. In Dutch, they're called weervissers, because they couldn't distinguish between seaweed and eelgrass. So they harvested the leaves at the end of summer and then they were dried in these sheds, special sheds for drying eelgrass. So it was big
wow.
business.
Wow.
And even one of the villages was named after this industry. It's called Wieringen. And they used it to stuff mattresses, insulate houses, but also to build dikes. Yeah, of course. So there was a huge history, but also a huge history of loss. Because when that closure dam was built, that also affected all sediment dynamics around Gint. At the same time, a wasting disease occurred that affected the eelgrass, but also the turbidity, so the clarity of the water diminished, and eelgrass needs sunlight to grow. So everything was wiped out within a few years.
And a lot of armoring of the shorelines as well, where the eelgrass might traditionally have been.
Well,
growing.
The thing is, it was just, so this dam was built in at the mouth of a big estuary. So that like one side just became freshwater where eelgrass can't grow. And on the other side, it was like fully saltwater. But because of the turbidity and that disease, it was not a slow decline. It was like in 2 years, everything was gone.
Everything was gone.
Yeah.
So what have you been doing to try to bring it back?
Yeah. So building up on this very rich history of eelgrass restoration in the Netherlands that already started in the 1950s, I started becoming involved in 2009 for my PhD. So both in the Delta and the Wadden Sea. So the Netherlands is not very big, but we have a lot of sea. So the Dutch Delta is also an area which used to be a huge estuary that has been heavily modified. So we have a huge history of seagrass loss everywhere. So yeah, I've been trying to get the eelgrass back in different ways. So there's two species that we're trying to restore, eelgrass and dwarf eelgrass. And for one species, we're really at the stage where we are upscaling it for eelgrass. And then for dwarf eelgrass, we're actually really just figuring out like the fundamentals and the science, the methodology. In the Wadden Sea, we now established actually quite a big restored intertidal eelgrass meadow. So that is intertidal, so that always falls dry. It's not subtidal. And then in the delta, we just started restoring subtidal eelgrass, so underwater, in this heavily modified marine lake. So it used to be an open estuarine system, but it's now a lake, so the tides are gone. All the tide flats have drowned. The eelgrass has disappeared over 20 years ago, so we're trying to bring it back there as well. So the question is also, is this still called restoration? Because it's restoration on a system scale, but of course you can't really get back to the original state of the system because it's been changed by dams and dikes, which won't go away.
So I wanted to ask you about this amazing, simple, but very effective technology that you helped to innovate for doing the eelgrass restoration. Can you tell me what that looks like?
Yeah, so one of our main hurdles was actually finding the right method for our eelgrass restoration. So we have to do seed-based restoration, so using seeds because we're working with this annual morphotype. So that means, you can't really transplant the plants because then you will actually damage the donor meadow. So we came up with a new method to kind of inject the seeds in the sediment using caulking guns just from the hardware store.
Like the same type of caulking gun that I used to put silicone on my bathtub.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah,
that kind of caulking gun. And so what we do is actually we mix seeds and mud from a location which actually still has seagrass. We kind of filter that mud so that there's no worms or stuff in there. And then we just mix a certain amount of seeds with it. And then we put it in the caulking gun and you inject it in the sediment. So it's as simple as that.
So you just go along and you just drop the gun, the tip of the gun into the sediment and you squeeze a bit and then you keep going. And
kind of, yeah. So we have modified the gun slightly so that we can actually control the amount of mud that we inject with every injection because we still want to kind of know how many seeds we put in a certain area.
Right.
So we modified it like with a screw so that you cannot kind of inject too much at one point. And instead of kind of injecting it at the tip, we actually glued the tip shut, and then we made a hole on the side because the thing is, if you inject mud, it has a certain viscosity, and then if you pull it back and you inject it from the tip, you actually kind of pull back all the mud.
So
now we kind of inject it on the side so that the mud stays in the sediment.
That's a lot of like fine complication, but it speaks to the effort that we go to figure out innovative ways of doing effective restoration.
Yeah. And it's so nice because it's a very low-tech method, right? Everyone can adopt it, and it has been adopted globally, I would say. They're using it around Europe, in Australia. We did a trial in the US here just across the border. So it's been working pretty well. So mostly in the intertidal, so on the tide flat, so walking. But we've also done some trials underwater.
So with like snorkel outfit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know some people in the UK are doing it diving. So they have a modified, like a bit like cooler looking caulking gun. So it's I think they made it heavier. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. It's amazing to think about these restoration projects and seeing them flourish, right? So you've shown me some aerial imagery shot from drones, time sequence over several years, looking at tiny little establishment where you've just seeded it in 1 year and then it grows. And it's really impressive to see that happen.
Yeah, the cool thing is, of course, we started this as like this was restoration science because we were developing the tools that we needed for large-scale restoration. But while we were fine-tuning this method, right, like finding out how many seeds we needed to inject or how deep and where that hole in the tip should be, actually a lot of the seeds washed out because the method wasn't perfect. And in that area, they established because it seemed like that whole area was very suitable where we planted them. So it's a huge area. And then we actually accidentally established a meadow. Like we kept on seeding every year, but more on an experimental scale. So we have like over the years until 2024, we've seeded around 3.5 hectares, 4 million seeds. And now we have 1,650 hectares growing there. And that is also because, of course, it's an annual plant. So it just produces a lot of seeds. And those seeds also disperse in that area. So it's actually been very effective. So next to seeding, actually all the plants that actually establish produce seeds and also continue to that success. So that because of that, they could actually disperse very quickly. So that was actually very cool to see. So it's always a bit of a surprise. So we go out again in September, so to see like where we're at now.
That's exciting. So I've learned a lot about seagrasses from eelgrasses from talking to you and being, you know, going out into the field with you. I've developed an enthusiasm for them. So thank you for that. But not everyone will know what eelgrasses are and why they're so important. And the fact that they're a photosynthesizing marine plant.
Yeah.
So just to walk us through why we should care about.
Yeah. Why should we care about eelgrasses? Actually, I call them our temperate coral reefs because they're as important as coral reefs. And most people can imagine coral reefs, right, from the documentaries as well. Okay, eelgrass is not as colorful, but it has a lot of fish and other species actually inhabiting the eelgrass. So it's like, this is what we call a foundation species. So it builds an ecosystem and it's formed by these marine flowering plants and they're called eelgrass or seagrasses. So eelgrass is just a species that grows here and in the Netherlands, but there's about 70 seagrass species globally. And they're flowering plants, so they're not algae because they kind of root in the sediment. And they look a lot like land grasses, so they also have these rhizomes underground and they have roots. And they can form these vast, vast meadows. And like in the tropics, they attract species like sea turtles and manatees that actually feed on the eelgrass. Sea otters also like to feed not on the eelgrass, but on all the critters that live in seagrass. So they're these biodiversity hotspots. And they're also really important fish nurseries. So current estimates are is that 10 to 20% of all the commercial fish species in tropical areas actually has been growing up in seagrass nurseries. So seagrass are super important for tiny fish because they provide shelter and there's lots of food in them. And they're also really powerhouses when it comes to carbon storage. So they store enormous amounts of carbon.
We'll come back to talk about this later, but they're also helpful in stabilizing the nearshore structures, right?
They're very important for coastal protection. So in two ways, because they provide structure, right? So the leaves can be up to 2 meters in the water column. And you can imagine waves and currents that kind of hit those leaves kind of slow down. So it's also the energy of waves and currents kind of goes down in seagrass beds, but also because they have these massive rhizome structures underground, they form this whole clonal network of roots. They actually hold on to the sediment and they prevent erosion.
Huh.
Yeah.
So I'm not very comfortable in these marine environments. You know that. I'm not a diver. I've snorkeled only occasionally. And I was forced out of a small boat to walk to an island. So I consider myself more of a terrestrial person. In fact, I occupy my preferred habitats in mountain environments, so far away from seagrass meadows. And for my whole career, I've had this idea of landscape, right? So landscape is made up of a patchwork of different types of ecosystems often and, well, perhaps all the time with people involved too in communities and people moving through the landscape. And I've come over the last decade or so to think about seascapes. So I hear that term a lot. But you threw another term at me that I think is a really very cool.
Yeah, so I mentioned wholescapes.
Wholescapes.
Yeah, so we have been struggling massively as marine ecologists because we're always considered like niche scientists, even though 70% of this planet is water.
70%.
Yep. Of course, there's also fresh water. But somehow, like terrestrial is still kind of mainstream and marine is niche. So we're trying to kind of fit in. And interestingly, we started working more on a seascape scale also to kind of indicate the importance of connectivity in marine systems. So seascape ecology is an emerging topic. However, what we actually want to do is, of course, bring the terrestrial and the marine and also freshwater realm together because freshwater is an important connector, right? So wholescape is also that when you work in marine systems, at least that's how we think about it, is that you include all the coastal areas, the terrestrial coastal areas, right? Not just the dunes, but also the hinterland, rivers, streams, everything is connected. And also you cannot manage coastal ecosystems without considering that. So it's a very, very emerging field. Yeah, I don't think it's in place yet, but I think it's good that we kind of start considering how to implement this terminology to kind of think more wholescape.
Well, and ecologists have taught us that there's much greater effects. We've known about effects of terrestrial systems like sediment runoff and pollution that goes into marine waters. And you see these, we're close to the mouth of the Fraser River, and you look at that from satellites in certain times of the year, you see this murky plume of water coming out the mouth of the Fraser and hitting Galliano Island and spreading out from there. It's quite dramatic.
Yeah.
But we've also learned that lots of sea organisms are mobilized onto the land as well.
Yeah.
You know, and we think a lot about salmon. That work has been popularized on the West Coast here, where salmon are going upriver very far into the inland and then being taken into terrestrial ecosystems by other creatures. So it makes sense to me that we don't just think about the interface, that we have one and the other and then an interface, but we actually see them together in a more profound way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's very important because, for instance, like these sediment plumes partially, of course, there's a natural sediment runoff from rivers, but we have massively altered those runoffs, for instance, by logging. So there's more erosion. And so in certain areas, like New Zealand, where logging is more recent than in many other areas in the world, you see actually that whole new tidal flats actually are being formed because of the very recent logging activities and erosion, or relatively recent. There's so much runoff that there's whole tidal flats and even islands being formed, right? So it's like it's so important that we realize that everything is connected. And generally, we think that way on islands, right? Mm-hmm. On islands, it's very apparent that everything is connected, the land and sea and nutrient cycling and like there's sea spray, etc. But it's much bigger than that.
Mm-hmm. It's true that in the field of ecosystem restoration, restoration ecology, that it's been dominated overwhelmingly by people work on land.
Yeah.
And some water, fresh water, but marine is really so far a small percentage.
Yeah, and I think it's actually developing very rapidly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so of course we're lagging behind massively. The field of marine restoration ecology has only been developing for 30 years. And then I think more recently in the past 10 years, it's really getting big. Also because, of course, there's a growing interest in restoration ecology, ecological restoration in general. There's more funding. However, the expectations are sky high because, of course, they see results mostly in terrestrial systems. So that is one of the challenges that we're kind of struggling with, to keep up with expectations. And also there's not always enough expertise actually to meet the requirements of funders. So, for instance, my first World Seagrass Conference was in 2012. There were 100 people globally working on seagrass, not restoration. This was seagrass biology.
Right.
And we had in April this year, 2025, we had the first European seagrass restoration workshop, 200 people only in Europe.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it really has expanded quickly.
Yeah, it is expanding. So, and that's just seagrass, right? And then there's many other fields in marine restoration ecology, especially shellfish reef restoration is growing. There's a huge restoration culture in coral reefs, salt marsh, and mangroves.
There's a certain invisibility to the marine restoration work. I mean, terrestrial systems, we can walk past them, we can see them. We're broadcasting from Victoria today on the traditional homes of the Lekwungen-speaking peoples. And so we can go and look at these cultural ecological restoration projects. And especially this time of year, they're so charismatic, right? All these common camas and great camas flowering and amazing. They're really beautiful. Yeah. And they're right there.
Yeah.
And there's interpretive signage in many of these projects, right? Dozens of projects. So seagrass is kind of charismatic because you can see it from shore, and anybody who's waded where there's seagrass, you know, will see it. But then beyond that, most people don't see it, right? It's invisible.
Yeah, there's a massive invisibility, not just of restoration, right, of marine habitats in general, because very few people, and also here, the water is pretty cold, so very few people actually go out and snorkel, like in contrast to some tropical islands, for instance, where people go and snorkel on coral reefs. So people don't see it, neither the kind of the systems that are out there, and then the restoration activities are even more visible, right? And I think that presents us with a challenge also because people don't really know what we're doing, but it's also harder to connect the people to the restoration activities, even though it involves people, right? Because we're not only restoring like a species, we're restoring the ecological integrity, the functionality, and also hopefully also the services these species provide to people. So there's an invisibility there, but there's also a huge invisibility of what the challenges are. Like, well, because first you want to reverse the cause of degradation before you start restoring, but it's sometimes very invisible in these systems what those are, whether they have actually been addressed, and also what other aspects contribute to that, like to what level the more current day modification are contributing to that.
Hmm. Let me challenge you a little bit to think about restoration in a changing world. So we've got lots of climate effects on ecosystems. This is well documented. we're definitely seeing sea level rise. And the systems that you're working in, how do we adapt to that?
That's a very important question because, of course, we're restoring in the now, but we have to look forward as well. And we can't fully look back. I think that's really important to realize because the systems have been modified to such an extent that we have to look forward. So in these intertidal systems, sea level rise is not always a pressing issue because they kind of partially, depending on the system, kind of can keep up with sea level rise because of sedimentation rates. So that depends on how much sediment there is available. But it is a pressing area. For instance, one of the areas I work in the delta in the southwest of the Netherlands is the Eastern Scheldt River. It used to be one arm of an open estuary, and the river was completely closed off for coastal protection measures. It's this huge plan called the Delta Works. So there's no riverine sediment input. And then they also built this storm surge barrier to kind of make sure that if there was a massive storm coming, they can close off the whole, which is now a lagoon, not an estuary, to protect the communities there. And they built massive dikes. So that actually means that the system is pretty sediment starved. So sea level rise is not the future. It's happening already.
Right.
So one of the things we're doing now is actually we have permission there for assisted migration of genotypes. So we're actually also now doing some trials right now as we speak. They were planted 2 months ago, seeds from Spain and from France. See if we can kind of, well, this is more temperature adaptation, see if we can introduce genotypes that are better resistant to rising temperatures, because that's also one of the vulnerabilities of the system. But luckily, the system has pretty good water quality because it was closed off from the river. So that's kind of a positive. That means that perhaps we can reintroduce submerged seagrass again, which grows like underwater, which might be more resistant to sea level rise. But of course, there's a lot of ifs and buts and maybes. We don't know what's going to happen. The good thing is we have permits to kind of play around with that and perhaps use this system as a bit of an experimental system to kind of figure out what the strategies are that we can implement.
Restoration is often very experimental. We're engaging a lot of trial and error to figure out the best way forward because these systems are so complicated.
And it's so interesting because we had massive successes in the Wadden Sea area, 1,650 hectares intertidal eelgrass restored. But it's not a one-on-one translation of these successes to these other systems that are even in the same country, right? Because there's generality, so the method we can actually transfer, but then every system comes with its own complexities, especially because they have been so modified. There's also a higher level of stochasticity, which is very hard to predict. So it is not only invisibility, but also unpredictability of like the system. So yeah, it's lots of trial and error. It's not paving a road.
Right. So let me challenge you a little bit on ideas of restoration, because you've used the term quite a bit. But the latest definitions that have come out through the Society for Ecological Restoration and the UN Decade on Ecosystem Restoration, which we're in the middle of, it's 2021 to 2030, really focus on this idea of a native reference ecosystem. How does that play for you in the work that you do?
Well, the Netherlands is a highly modified, highly densely populated country. We have almost no native ecosystems left, I would say. Everything is highly managed and it has ecological value. But for instance, the Wadden Sea area, which people actually see as like the most wild, untamed nature of the whole country, also because of the tides and the waves, you can't really see the modifications. It's one of the most degraded coastal ecosystems in the world in terms of over-exploitation, hugely modified species composition, lots of species have gone extinct. So that's just one case. So, and then we build dams and dikes, there's ongoing gas mining, fisheries, etc. But then the Dutch Delta, where I was describing this marine lake, right? There's no native reference system left. So it's really about how to restore or recover ecological integrity and optimize the functioning of these systems. But for instance, like because they completely closed it off, it's not the Eastern Scheldt, but two other areas have become marine lakes, which means there's no tides. So there's no connectivity with either the rivers, but also not with the North Sea area. So it's like a completely kind of static system. So there's less kind of daily dynamics. Completely different energy level. There's lots of invasive species. Yeah, so if you talk about restoration, definitely not restoration in the traditional sense. I don't think we can talk about that, but not just the Netherlands. I think that's the case for many European systems. And surprisingly, also being here kind of helps me to reflect on that a bit and also makes me realize that I think it's like talking about invisibility, it's not entirely visible for everyone, nature managers, policymakers, that these systems are so heavily modified and that we cannot go back to these reference systems.
Yeah, we have these models in our mind that suggest that we need to go back. And in some cases, we can do it. But in a lot of cases, it's really tough now. So we're trying to work in the best way we can with, you use the term ecological integrity, biodiversity, multifunctionality, all of the terms that have been developed to try to come to terms with this. I mean, somebody could, you know, easily ask why I, as a mountain focused terrestrial person, is interviewing somebody who's so focused on marine systems. And the answer really comes from my time in the Netherlands. I went there as a visitor in 2017 for a year with my family. That's when I met you and many of your colleagues at the University of Groningen in the north of the Netherlands and throughout the Netherlands. And I went there deliberately. I challenged myself, having been very much part of a North American view of ecosystem restoration, and especially on the West Coast here, I wanted to really provoke myself and see a different way of approaching the work. And it, as it turned out, the Dutch approach to restoration, rewilding, natuurontwikkeling, all these different concepts, that they kind of blew my mind when I was working there because it was so different. And it's helped me out. Anyway, so that was a long digression, but I just wanted to say that you come to Canada to learn about, you know, these wilder systems, and I went to the Netherlands to learn about these heavily transformed systems. There's a lot to learn from each, I think.
Yeah, I think for me, it's been eye-opening. Also, being here helps me to better reflect on what we are doing in Europe. Like this weekend, I was up island close to Comox, and there was so much eelgrass on the shore. I think there was more eelgrass just washed ashore than we have planted in the past year. Just like to kind of put it in perspective, right? So it's definitely a very different type of restoration than what's being done here on the West Coast. And doesn't mean that our systems are not valuable, right, or have ecological value. It's just a very different way of dealing with the restoration. And I think most Dutch perspectives are really also focused on technology, right? Like using technology for restoration. So also one of the things I've been trying to kind of integrate more in my work, which is very hard also, it's like also how do we bring people into it, right? To remove this invisibility, but also to gain support for restoration. Because surprisingly, support for restoration, especially marine restoration, is pretty low in the Netherlands. People see it as gardening, but not in a positive way, right? Mm. So there's lots of other ongoing activities, but as soon as you kind of trying to restore or rehabilitate, however you want to call it, rewild marine systems, people are like, no, you should leave it alone. It's like, I was actually talking to a German colleague, and they even have like a more extreme version there, not just seagrass restoration, just marine restoration in general. They just say, no, we don't do it. What's that? Remains that. So for me, it's really important to place that in the perspective of all the other activities that are ongoing, right? You could say like, yeah, management is just leaving something alone. But for me, it's also like, does a system have any natural capacity left to recover? And in our case, that's very limited. For instance, seagrass would never recover to the Wadden Sea because there's no propagules in the system. There's just no seeds or shoots left for it to come back from. Like the subtidal variety has gone extinct, and there's some meadows with seeds all the way in the northwest, but because of the current, the seeds won't ever get there.
Your colleague, a couple of your colleagues, Han Olf at Groningen, he was fond of kind of provoking me. You know, he'd take me to Oostvaardersplassen, which was featured on a previous Future Ecologies episode, a very unusual project. And he would sort of put his hands on his hips and say, so, Eric, is this restoration? And then I would like sputter. And then he would take me to an even more radical project like Markerwadden, which is in the Marker Meer, right? So not too far away from the area we've been talking about. So it's freshwater. And he would ask me again, you know, is this restoration? I have no idea. It's such a strange concept. So I got to know Lisbeth Bakker, who's a professor at the University of Wageningen, also the National Institute of Ecology in the Netherlands. And she's a exponent of rewilding.
So that is a good question. So I think everyone starts calling things restoration because of the decade, right?
The UN decade.
And that is also where the funding comes from, is for restoration. So I think rewilding in a marine system is not a very frequently used term yet. But I would say that, for instance, just planting eelgrass in those marine lakes, which they don't have any historical reference, you could call that rewilding potentially. And it's fun because we see fish coming back very quickly. Like you plant a few shoots and there's like a pipefish moving in. So that's very cool.
Yeah, so rewilding is a big movement in Europe. There's a variety of it in North America as well, but in Europe, it's taken off in a major way. And it's really about using species to kickstart the process of recovery in an ecosystem.
Yeah, and I think in Europe, it's really big, but again, in terrestrial systems. So right. I think most people know it in the context of trophic rewilding, right?
Yes.
Like Oostvaardersplassen, you bring back large grazers and they can kind of modify the system. Trophic rewilding in marine systems is very difficult because the high degree of connectivity. So they have used it actually by, like, for instance, putting rays back into a system. So they bred rays in captivity, and rays are mesopredators, so they can really modify food webs locally. They have an important role in the ecosystem, but they just swam away and they were never seen again.
Oops.
Yeah. Oops, you can't put a fence in a marine system. So I think that trophic rewilding is hard. And then the question is, like, the work we're doing with restoring these ecosystem engineers so that actually form the foundation of ecosystems, like restoring, well, we've been talking about seagrass beds, but also shellfish reefs, salt marshes, mangroves, you name it. Is that rewilding? Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, my understanding is that it would be. And especially the work that you described early in our conversation, where you were trying to get the blue mussels back and, you know, to stabilize and begin to engineer that marine system, that speaks to me of rewilding because it's about making an intervention that then, you know, mobilizes the ecosystem towards greater complexity, greater integrity, whatever that trajectory is. And it might be quite not what you would expect. So if you go to Rewilding Europe, the organization, you'll see these amazing examples, all terrestrial, I think, so far, where they've been introducing, in some cases, domesticated animals to graze and to start to, you know, get that system moving. It's fascinating work.
Yeah.
So I would say probably some of the work you've described with seagrasses and mussels and so on is a kind of rewilding because you're less looking backward and more looking forward.
Yeah, one of the projects that we've been doing in the Wadden Sea is from the project called Wadden Mosaic. And one of the structures we develop is our tree reefs. So one of my PhD students, John Dixon, who's actually from BC, developed these tree reefs from old pear trees. So there's a lot of fruit orchards in the Netherlands, and those trees are being cut down every 20 to 30 years when they're done producing fruit. So he developed these very low-cost tree reefs. So it's like an artificial reef, but made from old pear trees.
You're kidding.
And they're super effective. So you could call that rewilding, I guess.
I love that.
Because they bring back like all these hard substrate species, because the Wadden Sea, there's no rocks in the Wadden Sea. That's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
Like coming from here, there's no rocks. There's just sand and mud. So having these pear tree reefs is suddenly the structure, 3D structure into the water column. There's this hard structure for species to settle on, and it's shelter for fish. So he's shown with measurements that it attracts a lot of fish, and not just small fish, but also big fish that, again, predate on small fish.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're basically going out and planting dead pear trees underwater to create reefs.
Yeah, but they form a kind of a pyramid shape.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, so deploying pear tree reef pyramids. Yeah.
And you have some good visuals on some of these techniques, like you're looking at the eelgrass establishment, time lapse, and so we'll have to get those linked into this conversation so people can follow those up.
Sure.
They're fascinating.
Definitely.
So a couple of weeks ago, you and I both were attending a workshop in Dublin at Trinity College Dublin, organized by Marcus Collier, who has a novel ecosystems research group there. So what's a novel ecosystem?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's also novel definitions these days. But I would say it's an ecosystem with no historical precedent in terms of composition and structure, but which is kind of self-sustainable. So it's an unmanaged system, and it generally has these emerging properties and traits. And it's interesting because, well, I've been hearing also through you about novel ecosystems for a while, but suddenly also the whole context of novel ecosystems makes a lot more sense to me, especially because we're in restoration, we're encountering these challenges that only result from these emerging properties of novel ecosystems. So novel species interactions that you suddenly have, like an invasive worm that is kind of preventing seagrass to grow, right? Or kind of gluing leaves together and causing. And then we have a snail coming in, an invasive snail that is actually kind of taking over the role of lost grazers. And we encounter these novelties. And I feel we need this concept to also understand how we should proceed with restoration or rewilding in the context of all these novel marine ecosystems.
Yeah. So the concept started a little more than a decade ago, and you described it really elegantly as you know, ecosystems without historical precedent. So either functions or arrangements of species we haven't seen before. And it's developed beyond that in the last few years, where people are now talking about a broader concept called ecological novelty, which knits together both that sort of site-specific idea of a novel ecosystem. So this is a, you know, you describe a novel seagrass system that's got new species moving into it, but also the kind of evolutionary development and direct interventions in these systems that are producing kind of novelty of a different kind. You were talking about the experiments where you're introducing seagrasses from Spain further north. That's interesting new genotypes that's, you know, causing interactions that we can't fully understand. And we're also experimenting increasingly with genomic interventions in systems too, because this is important for us to be breeding species that, you know, will be resistant to higher temperatures or different amounts of wetting or all sorts of phenomena we haven't fully anticipated. And so we ourselves are doing this kind of intervention. So this broader notion of ecological novelty is starting to come in a more profound way within ecology more generally.
Yeah, and I think it's extremely important to consider both in the ecological and then specifically also in a restoration context, because it affects how our systems function. But it's extremely important, I think, to be aware of the existence of ecological novelties also in a management context. I've been having these conversations, especially with managers that are like pristinists, but then in Dutch systems, right? In European systems.
So you said pristinists?
Yeah. So they consider natural systems as kind of a wilderness. Like the natural systems we have in the Netherlands, they consider them as a wilderness rather as modified systems or systems with like a high level of ecological novelties. Mm. And I think that's problematic, because if you don't take the novelties into account in a management context, I think you're missing things. And what I see is also that it affects how we perceive systems and the support for restoration also even on a governmental level, and not just in the Netherlands. I think that's the case in the whole world, probably, that we're really unaware of this rising novelty in all kinds of aspects, right? Of course, there's a different levels of novelties, but also we have a huge appreciation for novelty, I think, in terms of urban green spaces, all kinds of parks. But in other spaces, especially marine systems that are considered wilder because they're governed by tides and and currents, and they are invisible. So there the novelty is very invisible, I think. So which makes it also harder to kind of manage for the novelty, and also to make sure that people still appreciate those systems, right? Novelty doesn't mean that we should appreciate those systems less, because they can still have high ecological integrity. And I think that is really important too. It's not a value judgment, novelty. It's just an observation, I would say.
Yeah, it's something that Jens Svenning at the workshop in Dublin was mentioning, that he really sees the value of the novel ecosystems concept as being a descriptive one, saying, this is what's changed, and less evaluative. Although, you know, it's been a complex term. I think it's a bittersweet term, right? Yeah. Because I have a lot of nostalgia for ecosystems that once were, or ecosystems that are persistent and they have remarkable qualities that are continuous over a long period of time. And yet, on the other hand, I see denial of novelty being something that holds us back from being able to do something that's nature positive.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think everyone has this nostalgia, right? That's also why I appreciate coming here to BC so much. I have to admit that, because I really appreciate the ecosystems here. Well, they're definitely wilder. I wouldn't say they're pristine wilderness, but they're definitely wilder than most European systems. And that is something I really appreciate as an ecologist and seeing. So I would say the nostalgia is almost everywhere. But that doesn't mean that the systems that we have in Europe have less value, right? Yeah, it's a challenging concept, but we kind of need to find our way around to like how do we appreciate novelty and how do we perhaps also optimize the functioning, the multifunctionality of some of those systems as well.
Taking us back to the island of Grind that we began this conversation with, the weather eventually turned nice. Do you remember? It was kind of misty early morning cold and then the sun came out and it was got kind of nice later in the day. And there were four of us, I think, or five of us, part of a scientific team. Hanold was there. And it was a really curiosity-driven experience that day. We were trying to look at this island and think of sort of new observations, new questions that we could ask. It was a very rich, like, few hours on that island. For me, I began to see this different imaginative future. Those experiments with the mussels didn't work, but maybe they will under a different kind of regime, like a different way of doing it. Maybe we'll start to gradually mobilize sediments again, be able to get more seagrasses going. And I began to think, rather than this gloomy, steady decline of ecological characteristics in the Wadden Sea, I began to see a more hopeful future.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And one of the ideas we have is that actually the seagrass just northeast of Grind can be there because of all those nature management measures, because all that sand kind of ended up on that tide flat and it became very stable. So there's actually a lot of new opportunities emerging for restoration, for recovery. So I'm actually pretty positive.
Whoa, that's not a bad place to end.
No.
Well, thank you. What a pleasure it's been to sit down and talk to you and recall some of our adventures together and hopefully many more in the future. But thanks for helping a landlubber like myself to appreciate these marine systems.
Yeah, thank you so much, Eric, and also for hosting me here and helping me to kind of zoom out of the European perspective here and there. It has been very formative throughout my work in the past years. And I really appreciate being here and talking about these things and those precious memories. Thank you.
Great. See you on a seagrass meadow someday soon.
Oh, yes, I'll bring you there. Fidelity.